During the Great Depression of the 1930s, the federal government hired many unemployed people through the Works Progress Administration and put them to work on, well, lots of different things. In one of these projects, the WPA hired writers to fan out across America to document what America was eating for a work that would be entitled America Eats. From those accounts, it is evident that what we were eating now is not what we were eating then. And this leads us to ask, for which foods from a younger land do you hunger?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 639th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Ushuaia who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
And hello, Mikey.
He says hi, too.
Mikey says hi, too. Okay, good. Also, engineer, we have producer Carol Stafford.
Hello.
And Parmalee Taff.
Hello.
Folks, several years ago, I had the opportunity to visit San Antonio, Texas for the first time. I looked forward to this trip because it would give me a good taste of South Texas and a little of the Deep South and perhaps maybe even some of Old Mexico as well. But what I found in San Antonio was what I find on any commercial street anywhere in America. Franchise eateries serving up franchise foods that look, smell, and taste exactly the same, whether one is in San Antonio, Texas, or Santa Cruz, California. Why bother going anywhere when everywhere is exactly the same? But wait, just when I thought all was lost, I caught the scent of food. Real food, and the sounds of song, as in real singing. I was walking the River Rock in downtown San Antonio when I caught the scent and sound and so followed them off the walk and into the neighborhood where I was led to a small city park, which was, at the time, hosting a community gospel music festival. On stage, singers were singing up a foot-stomping, hand-clapping, alleluia, alleluia storm, and ringing the park were a good score or so of smiling people in stands selling South Texas barbecue. Alleluia, alleluia. A couple of years later, looking back, I remember visiting the Alamo and the Riverwalk and meeting lots of nice San Antonians, but what I really love remembering is that gospel music festival with its spirit-filled singing and its South Texas barbecue. From my visit to South Texas and many other visits hither, thither, and yon, I have come to believe that foods with character still exist in America, but you might have to look real hard and get really lucky to find it. Today we are going to look back to the foods of our character-filled past and ask for which foods from a younger land do you hunger. And here to help us sniff around for some in our past, we have Mark Kurlansky, who is the author of The Food of a Younger Land. Welcome back to the Food Chain, Mark. Good to have you.
Nice to talk to you.
So last time we talked about the big oyster, history on the half shell, and the history of kind of the New York City area and scene from the half shell of an oyster. And you also wrote cod and salt. And what on earth, how did you become such a foodie? New York City boy at all.
Well, I don't know. I have always been interested in food. And I think it's a universal experience. We all eat. And we all, throughout human history, have always eaten. And so it's a great tool for looking at history and for anthropology, and you come to understand a lot. You know, in my oyster book, you came to understand a lot about New York City by looking at its oyster bed.
Right, right.
Food of a Younger Land. You understand a lot about America and America's past by looking at this unpublished WPA writing from 1940.
Well, the Works Progress Administration, what on earth were they doing in the 30s and 40s back then? Which, of course, is some history about our country, right?
Well, you know, it was a very different time from today. It was a time when a charismatic Democrat was elected president, replacing an unpopular Republican at a moment of economic crisis, and he wanted to have an economic stimulus package, which the Republicans opposed.
Mm-hmm.
But where things get different is, did an interesting thing, got a bill passed, which allotted a budget to do small projects and didn't specify what they were. And then they started doing all of these interesting projects that, you know, never would have passed Congress. Congress never voted on them. The WPA was accomplished by an executive order, as was the Federal Writers Project, the Federal Artists Project, which employed people like Mark Rothko, and the Theater Project, which employed Orson Welles and Joseph Cotten and all these different things. The Federal Writers Project employed at its height about 6,800 people. You didn't have to show any skill or experience as a writer to qualify. The main thing to qualify was to show that you were broke.
Well, that would probably fit, be an apt description for most writers, wouldn't it? You're broke.
It would. Most writers and a lot of other people.
Uh-huh.
So,
especially in the 1930s. You know, you mentioned the WPA artist projects, and I think we see a lot of that's left over today in post offices, right?
Absolutely. Lots of government buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, murals.
And, a lot of murals, right.
And a lot of great architecture also.
Well, so who were some of the famous authors that participated in the America Eats project?
Well, there was Claude McKay from the Harlem Renaissance and Zora Neale Hurston. And there were a lot of people who went on to be famous artists, writers like Nelson Algren and mm-hmm. John Cheever and Ralph Ellison and Richard Wright and Kenneth Rexroth, the original beat poet. And
wow, lots of big names then.
Yeah. No, they weren't big names at the time. Saul Bellow.
Mm-hmm. So
but also a lot of people who had never written in their lives.
A good place to start. So the government sent them out across the land. What was their charge? What were they commanded?
Well, originally they were doing guidebooks.
Oh.
Catherine Kellogg, who took charge of this, realized that there were no guidebooks to America. There was only a 1909 Baedeker written by a Brit. There were no guidebooks on America. Americans traditionally don't examine America very much, and it's always been foreigners who have done it. And in the 1930s, there was this great movement to start, during the Depression, to start taking a look at America. They did guidebooks to all 48 states and most major cities and some minor cities. And these books got rave reviews from important literary critics and were bestsellers, and some of them are still in print today and good reading. It was a tremendous success, but, you know, they've done guidebooks to almost everywhere, and so the next idea that they came up with was to do a book about food in America, how Americans ate, the kind of food they ate, the kind of social gatherings they had, the kind of food traditions that they had, and
If I might interject, it's very much like you, Mark Kurlansky. You know, you use food to look at culture, and I
guess
exactly that's what they were doing then. They were going to
That's right. And they had the country was broken up into five regions, and there were going to be five regional essays, all done by fairly accomplished writers, like Nelson Algren did the one for the Midwest. And all of these 6,000 people were scouring the country. You know, they sent in recipes and descriptions and accounts of gatherings and poems and short stories. And most of this stuff was never going to be published. It was just going to inform these five writers for their big regional essays. But then, December 7th, 1941, Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and everybody knew that the WPA was not going to be lasting much longer because World War II was coming. And the archives in which
the ultimate financial stimulus package, right?
That's right. And the archives where I got most of these manuscripts also had correspondence, and I saw letters that went out on December 8th and December 9th from Catherine Kellogg in Washington saying, get your manuscripts in, whatever you have, just send it in. You know, we'll try to get something done before we close out. So stuff was shipped in, thousands and thousands of pages of unedited manuscripts, And they were closed down, and she lost her job. And she took all these manuscripts, and she just dumped them in boxes in the Library of Congress, where they have been sitting ever since.
And where you found them.
Yeah.
And that was like, and that was the genesis of the new book, The Food of a Younger Land, by Mark Kurlansky. We're going to take a quick break, but we're going to, when we come back, we're going to talk about some of those foods from a younger land, and we're going to look back at see if we can call up any in our own memories and talk about them. And one of the foods of a younger land that I remember and I especially miss is chokecherry syrup. Ooh, what do you miss? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. Today we're talking about the history of our food and how our foods have changed and what it says about our culture, too. Do you miss a food from a younger land? Give us a call and let us know what it is. We're at 831-479-1080, 800-624-2665. Right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
We're looking back at the food of a younger land, and we're doing it with Mark Kurlansky, the author of such a book. Mark dug through the Library of Congress and found a whole bunch of boxes containing manuscripts from the early 1940s, late 1930s. Works Progress Administration sent writers out across America to see what we were eating and in what we were eating, how we were living. Mark, that must have been fun, kind of thumbing through all of these pages. I can imagine you down there in the basement, you know.
No. It was in the regular library. They bring it out to you, wheel it out in a cart.
Wheel it out.
But it was kind of felt like one of those fantasy stories where you accidentally stumble through a hole and find yourself in 1940. In a lot of ways, there was just this sense of having entered this other world. All the manuscripts, or most of them, were on that old onion skin paper, and they were carbon copies because, you know, there were no photocopy machines.
Right, right.
And
the kind of the blurred type of the typewriter ribbons.
They were carbon. The carbon copies were very blurry, and sometimes there were second carbons. I'm actually old enough to remember doing that. Try to get about 5 carbon copies to your type manuscript.
Well, Mark, you're a boomer, right? You were kind of born after World War II.
Yeah, I was born in 48.
48, and you look back, I guess I'm kind of in the same genre there, same generation, and we look back, and I still remember some of those foods, and I suspect you do. And I was talking with mid-80s friend of mine who was raised in Brooklyn, and I was talking about the food of a younger land, and I asked her what, you know, she remembers about the food, and she remembers the fact that her family was so poor that they could only afford one chicken per week, and they would make that one chicken last the entire week by, you know, cutting it up very carefully and preparing different dishes with it, and they would use that chicken protein to amplify lots of vegetables and whatnot.
Soups and stews,
and everything, yeah. She looked back on that with real fondness and remembered the delicious vegetables that were the consequence of the chicken.
But there's a number of recipes in this book that remind you that we're talking about the Depression. There's a recipe from Maine for chowder. you know, and you start by cooking down the salt pork and potatoes and some onions, and then, you know, you can add clams or fish and milk and stuff. But she also says, if you don't have any of this stuff, you can stop right there and call it potato chowder.
Right.
And followed the recipe, and it was a great soup. And there's another thing called the Depression Cake from, I think it was Montana, where it was 4th of July, and she didn't have any eggs, and she didn't have any butter, and she made this cake out of almost nothing. You know, it was flour and a lot of spices and a lot of baking powder and pork fat. And she baked it up, and everybody was amazed that it was actually good. And I tried this with a Boston chef, and it's a wonderful cake.
Huh.
I have to admit, no one was more surprised than me that a lot of the recipes in this book are really good.
And actually taste good. You know, let's look back at some of the stories that you came up with, some of your favorites. Let's give the folks an idea of what life was like back then. Let's start with the New York Literary Tea.
Yeah. I like the New York Literary Tea because, you know, I've never heard it called a literary tea, but I've gone to a lot of things called book parties that fit this description exactly. Very funny piece about how, you know, it had to be crowded and nobody could really talk about anything important and spent most of their time talking about how much different writers were making and how big their advances were. And it all sounded very familiar 70 years later.
Pretty much the same thing. Nebraska eats the wieners.
This is going to be my claim to immortality, is that I rescued from obscurity into American literature that poem. If it weren't for me, it would have gone unknown, which was probably the hope of the author.
Right. You.
But I liked it because I've spent a lot of time in the Midwest, and it's very much, Midwesterners have this wonderful sort of self-effacing sense of humor.
And you know, when you looked at the country in sections as they were putting together America Eats, and, you know, they divided the country into five sections, what do you see, what is the primary difference, you know, as you go from one section of the country to the other with respect to the foods that we were eating back then?
Well, they all had very distinct cuisines, including the Midwest. You know, people go to the Midwest today and they go to, you know, major cities where chain restaurants have completely taken over. And they don't know that these places have cuisines. But if you go to rural places and really look around, you know, they still make persimmon pudding in southern Indiana. The big difference is that the food described in this book was the food of America in 1940. And today, this food still exists, but you have to be a detective to find it.
Exactly, exactly. Why did it change? I mean, let's talk about the essential character of food back then. We were much closer to our food back then, correct?
Yeah, it was really the fulfillment of some of the movements of today. You know, it was slow food and it was local food. And
it was everything we aspire for our food to be, right?
That's right. That's right. But it was of necessity, you know. It wasn't a movement. You know, so it had its downsides. Like, you know, you spent most of September and October canning food so that you'd have stuff to get through from November to April. You know, it's sort of a funny thing. When I was traveling around the country talking about this book, I was heading for Seattle, and a journalist in Seattle said, "Well, you know, you're getting here at just the right time because the Copper River salmon is coming in." And I didn't have the heart to tell him that I knew the Copper River salmon was coming in because my neighborhood fish store in New York gets the Copper River salmon as soon as it comes in.
Right.
And, you know, it's a two-edged thing. I'm glad to have the fish, but, you know, it takes some of the fun and excitement out of food when it's not identified with a local place, you know, and you don't have the sense. As I travel around America, I try so hard in my meals to get a sense of where I am and the time of year that it is, and it's very hard to do, but it was the most natural thing in 1940.
And why did it change some? What changed it? I mean, we're talking pre-World War One, World War II.
World War II, yeah, a lot of different things changed. One of the big things is that in the 1960s, the National Highway System was completed. So we stopped traveling on these two-lane highways that went from town to town. There's a piece in there from Virginia about driving on Route 1 and stopping along the highway and sampling different things. And it even says that, you know, if you're not getting the stuff you want, just pull up and knock on someone's door. And, you know, I read that and I thought, well, this is a different America than what I know.
Totally different America, isn't it?
And they didn't, you know, food wasn't being flown around all over the world or even all over the country. And, you know, even when I was a kid in the 1960s, I remember it was a big event to get some out-of-season, you know, carrots from California or a melon from Texas. Or I remember once I sent grapefruit from Florida, and it was really exciting.
Yeah.
Today they move that stuff around for us, and we've lost our sense of local. And in the process, we've also, of course, lost a lot of our, you know, small family farms. Family farms are still, you know, hundreds of thousands of them are closing every year. And we've traded that in for agro-industry.
What did we get in return?
Well, we got nothing. What we were supposed to get was an end to hunger in the world, and that completely failed. And that was the deal, that we were going to lose some culture, and we were going to lose some quality of the food, but food was going to become plentiful, and hunger was going to end. And it turns out that hunger is not about the food supply, but about the food distribution.
Okay, folks, you're tuned into The Food Chain, and we are talking food with Mark Karlansky, the author of The Food of a Younger Land. How young? Well, kind of right at the end of the Great Depression. And the Works Project Administration sent writers out across the land to see what we were eating, and what we were eating was local. And we will be right back to talk about that local food and what it meant to us, right? Well, do you remember any of the foods of a younger land? Maybe if you were a baby boomer or older, maybe you do remember some of them. But if you're younger, if you're a Gen Xer, you probably don't. For example, I remember fresh, whole, raw milk. I remember going out to the barn with my grandpa and milking cows and carrying buckets of that milk back to the house and putting it in a separator and separating some of the cream from the milk. And I remember reaching into the refrigerator for some of that milk. You had to shake it, of course, because there was a lot of cream still in it. And you shook it and you shook it and you poured it into a glass. And it was so incredibly rich. Oh, my God. Compared to today's milk, it was just a whole different thing. No similarities whatsoever. And that's kind of what happened to our food. It just doesn't look or taste or smell the same anymore. Mark Karlansky, in The Food of a Younger Land, you kind of described this process with respect to how Mexican food has changed over the course of the last few decades.
Yeah, you know, I remember when I was a kid, I mean, there was no Mexican food except in the Southwest, and being right. Just completely fascinated by it, going there. I remember discovering a taco for the first time at Pismo Beach in California. And, you know, these things were wondrous new things. But what kept Mexican food local was the making of tortillas. And then in the 60s, they developed these machines for cranking out tortillas. And as soon as that happened, Mexican food started popping up everywhere.
Right. What was the difference between
handmade anymore?
What was the difference between the handmade tortillas and the machine-made tortillas?
Oh, I don't know how to, you know, where to begin. They tasted like corn, and I used to live in Mexico, and you know, they have a lot of machine-made tortillas there too. But you know, in a sort of a sexist way, I knew a lot of Mexicans and what they looked for. I mean, it was said the typical campesino thing is what you look for in a woman is somebody who was willing to still make the tortillas by hand. You know, they were a little bit irregular, but they really tasted of corn, and just no comparison.
You know, in a rush to industrialize our food chain and make it possible for somebody in New York to eat a carrot from someplace in California, and so on and so on, all the way across the food chain. Did we kind of look down our nose at peasant food, at the campesino who makes corn tortillas? Did we kind of looking down our nose at brown breads?
Well, yes. This other thing happened, starting with people like Julia Child. I love Julia Child. But Julia Child spearheaded a movement in which everything that was not from here was great. She popularized French food, and not that it wouldn't have happened without her, but she was one of the great exponents of French food in America. Mm-hmm. And good food and American food became contradictory terms in people's minds, and then in reality, they really did become contradictory. You look at this book and you think, there was a time when there was an American cuisine, and when visiting America was like visiting France or Italy or Spain, in that you've got a completely different cuisine, a completely different kind of food in different parts of the country, even in different counties. It wasn't just food. People used to have different accents. I grew up in Connecticut, and which is a very small state. And when I was a kid, I could tell you what part of Connecticut. I was from the center. I was from Hartford, and I could tell you what part of Connecticut people were from by their accent. I don't think you can do that anymore.
Probably not. Probably couldn't tell somebody from Connecticut from somebody from Iowa anymore when it gets right down to it.
Imagine that.
and such with the food as well. And I guess, that's one of my great lamentations, is that I miss traveling. I think that our industrialization has really taken the joy out of traveling and to new places and seeing new things and discovering new tastes. It's just
absolutely. And one of the things that comes with industrialization is homogenization.
Yes,
a word I can't even say. Tendency for everything to become the same.
I have a question for you. You travel a lot, promoting your book and whatnot. When you wake up in the morning in a hotel and you walk out of the hotel door, do you always know which way to turn?
Which way to turn?
Yes, to get to the exit. I find myself staying in hotels, and they're all the same. And you walk out of the hotel, out of your room in the morning, and you go, oh God, which way do I turn?
I try not to stay in those hotels, but I know that feeling. I get up in the morning and I want to have the local breakfast. It was one of the things that struck me when I was a kid. There were six of us in our family, and we had this, huge Buick that sat six people comfortably, and we drove. All over the country, ended up in San Francisco where we had relatives, and then drove back by a different route. And we did this every summer. And it was just striking to me, the differences. And one of the differences was that the way breakfast changed. Breakfast is almost nothing in New England, and it gets a little bigger in New York, and it just keeps getting bigger as you go out west. And hamburgers were like that, too. You order a hamburger in New England. I come from a very stingy part of the country. You order a hamburger, you get a hamburger. You always have to specify the bun if you want bread with it. And, as you travel west, you get more and more of the hamburger. This was in the 1950s. And, when you got to California, you had this whole salad on the hamburger.
Right, lots of greens and whatnot. One of the things that really made food local over the years was the local food festivals. And it's interesting to see what's happening to food festivals as we lose local foods. One of the examples, of course, is the Gilroy Garlic Festival. And, of course, Gilroy, California used to be the garlic capital of the world. Well, The garlic now comes from China, but they still have the Gilroy Garlic Festival using garlic from China. And it's just another example, I guess, of what happens when you lose your local food. You really start to lose your identity.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Pennsylvania used to be the mushroom growing capital of America. Now there's mushrooms all over the place. But the book is full of these kinds of food festivals, and some of them have survived, but a lot of them haven't. There's still, Indiana still has its persimmon festival in the fall, and there's still lutefisk festivals in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And
Lutefisk. Oh, when we get back, it's lutefisk. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking with Mark Kurlansky about the food of a younger land. One of those foods is lutefisk. Have you ever tried it? Oh, I'm sure you'd love it. We'll talk lutefisk. And what do you miss in those foods from a younger land? What do you hunger for that you can't get anymore? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Foods from a younger land. There were many, and they were all different, and they were all very local. And for the most, they're all gone now. And one of them being lutefisk. Of course, if you're of Scandinavian heritage, such as Michael Olson, you are aware of lutefisk. But that doesn't mean anybody could induce you to eat it, and nobody ever induced me to eat lutefisk, I'll tell you that. What on earth is it, Mark Kurlansky?
Well, it's a delicious concoction of codfish that has been cured in lye.
Codfish cured in lye?
Cured in lye, yes. I always thought it was a rather gelatinous, gooey sort of thing, but recently, while talking on Wisconsin Public Radio, somebody called in and told me that that's because I was having overcooked lutefisk, and that if it's cooked right, it's actually delicious.
So what does lye do to a lutefisk, to a cod?
It breaks it down, but it also preserves it.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a pickling.
Yes, yeah. There's a curious thing in food that there's actually a thin line between preserved and rotten. And this was originally a way of preserving it. And interestingly, I found two manuscripts for lutefisk, one from the Wisconsin Federal Writers Project and one from the Minnesota Federal Writers Project. And I went with the Wisconsin one because I felt it was more interesting. The big difference between these two manuscripts was that in Wisconsin, they said that, you know, this food is a little hard to take when you first initiate it. And in the Minnesota one, they said that everybody loves this on first being introduced. I thought, well, they're lying in Minnesota.
Not going with that one, right?
Right.
But what is it about lutefisk and the Scandinavian culture? I mean, why on earth would they hold on to something like lutefisk?
It's a tremendously interesting thing because the truth is that many of the people who eat lutefisk don't really like it. But it is a Christian kind of thing. It's their heritage. It recalls their past. We eat lutefisk because we're Scandinavian. And that's one tradition like the lutefisk, preserved. There's still a lot of lutefisk festivals in Wisconsin and Minnesota where there are a lot of people of Scandinavian ancestry. And it's kind of like, I'm Jewish, and I actually don't do this, but a lot of Jewish people on Passover and different Jewish holidays, they eat these foods from when we were impoverished people in shtetl,
as a way of holding on.
Yeah, as a way of connecting with culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, and certainly, because that's something you couldn't do with a ballpark hot dog, right? It just wouldn't be there.
Well, I don't know. You know, it's now ballparks like the one in San Francisco that keeps changing its name because the corporation keeps changing. I don't know what it's called.
I think it's AT&T now, but it could might be something else.
Yeah. And you know, and you can get all kinds of wonderful food there, but for some reason, when I go to a ballpark, I want a hot dog.
Right.
Is it? That's what you're supposed to eat when you watch a ball game.
Right, right. That's what you tune in with. That's how you get tuned into the ball game. You eat a hot dog. A gourmet fish sandwich or something, not going to work. You need the hot dogs for this to work. So,
yeah, it's baseball.
So what happens when we lose our local foods? What happens? You know, you look at food.
Well, it's losing our culture.
And, yeah. You know. And when we lose our culture, what's left?
Well, then we start losing our sense of identity and a sense of who we are and a sense of history. The whole fabric of society starts falling apart.
Do you see that? I mean, you're the person who looks at food and culture. You're the food historian. You look at how cod changed the world. And the impact salt made on the world. And
I see it, but I also see people being tremendously tenacious. And in fact, I have found that most of the traditions in this book are being preserved somewhere by somebody. That there are always people who are the guardians of our culture and with that, the guardians of our traditional food. And all of these movements today, I think are a very healthy thing and, you know, a renewed, respect for the family farm. Family farms are very culturally important. They're the fabric of society in farming places, and to be replaced by corporations, not only changes the food, but it changes the local society. And you know, there are now markets almost everywhere in America a few days a week that feature products from local family farms. And there's all kinds of things going on trying to protect this stuff because people do understand what we're in danger of losing, and they're rebelling against losing it.
Right. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We are talking with Mark Kurlansky, who is the author of The Food of a Younger Land, a wonderful anthology of works put together for a WPA project called America Eats in the early 1940s. The project ended unceremoniously with the greatest stimulus package of all, attack on Pearl Harbor. And thus, the project was put into big boxes and shipped to the Library of Congress, where Mark found them and gently picked pieces of paper out of them and found these incredible stories of a food from a younger land. Which food do you miss? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Well, a couple minutes left and miles and miles and miles to go with Mark Kurlansky, who is the author of The Food of a Younger Land. And just a few short decades ago, we were a much younger land. It's kind of interesting to note, Mark, that, 40 years ago, we were a very much younger land, weren't we? In terms of...
Yeah, I mean, it was really striking reading this stuff. It was a different country in a lot of ways.
A different world, and we were a different people, and we were slower and more local. Mark, you know, there's an organization, a United Nations organization called the Codex Alimentarius, whose objective in life, I guess, is to enforce a uniformity across the world's food chain so that an apple in China will taste and look and be exactly the same as an apple in Denmark, for example. And yet, there is a whole bunch of people who call themselves, among other things, local vores and local foodists, who are kind of like, you know, giving the universal salute to that whole notion of uniformity and saying that we should get back to a more local foods and foods with character, and because foods with character tend to make people with character. Is there room in the world for both directions, do you think?
Well, that seems to be where we're going. And, you know, one of the things I'm a little concerned about is that the good local food tends to be going to affluent people.
Mm-hmm. And it should be peasant food.
It should be the other way around.
Yeah.
Right? That could be a problem. But we seem to be going towards this world in which there's, you know, good artisanal food for people who can afford it and mass-produce corporate food for everyone else.
It seems like, though, the artisan foods that you talk about back in the 30s and early 40s would have been considered peasant foods. Am I wrong there?
Oh, very much so. And you know, this book and the recipes in this book were very much shaped by the Depression and the fact that, you know, a lot of people were in desperate circumstance. In fact, a lot of the people who worked on it, who worked in the Federal Writers Project, said that they would have starved if it wasn't for this program. And it was very much about affordable food, you know, local food that was affordable.
And those local foods that were affordable, those peasant foods of that time, have now become the artisan foods of today, the fresh, the local.
Absolutely. Like the milk you were talking about earlier, you can get that milk if you're willing to pay for it.
And you have to pay a lot, too. And it's
good.
And so where are we going? You know, as a food person, you know, you look down the highway because for a person who's looked in the past, I'm sure that you look in the future. As you look in the future, where do you see us heading with our food?
Well, I think that, you know, it's very healthy, these movements back to local and more artisanal and all of that. But really what people are trying to do is get the best of both worlds, you know, so that then when the great local food is out of season, you can fly in something from somewhere else.
Sure.
Somebody else's local food. And, you know, that may end up being a system which is not, you know, is not that bad a system, except that it'll, you know, it'll just be for the people who can afford it.
Yeah, and there you go. Well, you know, this has been a lot of fun. I always have fun with you because I love the topics of your contemplations. And you always have a fun way of looking at the world through our food. And
you always ask good questions.
Thank you, Mark Kurlansky, author of The Food of a Younger Land. His name is Kurlansky. Just Google Kurlansky, K-U-R-L, and you'll pick up some absolutely fun stuff about foods, the foods we eat. You know, the best-selling author of The Cod and Salt and The Big Oyster and a lot of fun things. And I admire your works, and I'm so happy to have you on the show today. Thank you so much out there. Hey, remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.